let's all join together and welcome Roberto.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, this, so a few people here, if you have any, if you don't understand what I'm saying because of my sexy accent or because of something, let me know and we can go back and forth in this thing. So this can be very informal. Today, what I'm going to talk about is the chytrid fungus and how, what is going on in the world in the chytrid fungus and what the research in chytrid has been for the last 10, 15 years and what the chytrid research is now and what parts we're focusing on right now. So first, let's talk about the problem. What was going on with the chytrid? And the problem was, like, several years ago, frogs start dying and disappearing, and people start realizing that the animals were gone. So from the 1980s to now, many populations, especially in Central America, South America, Australia, start declining. And these declines were very mysterious. Nobody really knew what was going on. So the most intriguing part was that these things were happening in remote areas with no people around, and it was no signs of disturbance of any kind. Nobody was logging, nobody was adding pesticides or anything, and the things started disappearing. So around the 1980s, they started linking the chytrid fungus to these die-offs, mostly in tropical areas, in montane tropical areas, as you probably all know. So what is the chytrid? Who's the chytrid? The chytrid is a fungus part of the chytrid family, which is a very diverse family, very big bunch of different chytrids. And this is the only one of those chytrids that is actually a pathogen to vertebrates. All the other ones live in harmony and happy with vertebrates, but this one started for some reason killing the things. It lives in the skin of the frogs, the layers, the first layers of the skin of the frogs, and also is found in the mouth parts of larvae, in the keratin tissue, mostly. They have three life stages. The source pore is aquatic, and it's flagellated, and it's very, very tiny. And then the talus lives in the skin of the frog, and the sporangium is the structure who release, oops, there you go. So this is a piece of the skin of a frog, and each of these little circles here, I guess I should use this cool thing here, are the sporangium. So when you take a look at that closer, you see this is the mouth part of a tadpole, and this is a sporangium that is opening, and this is a great opening, and it's using the source pores in this very moment. So the source pores are tiny, and they will go and get in the water and stay there for a while. So what do we know about the chytrid? So far we know that it likes temperature between 17 and 24 degrees. If it gets up to 31 or 30, the chytrid will die. We know that he loves the water because they have flagellated source pores, so they need the water to be able to reproduce. And it doesn't seem to have a resting stage. It cannot stand, get dry, so it doesn't have resting stage. We know that in the wild, we can find for up to 7 weeks in pond water. It's been studied to prove that it can live for 6 weeks in mesocosms. And in the environment, like in a stream, we know that at least for 3 days, it is alive without a host. So where did it come from? How did this start? There are two groups of people that think different things. The first hypothesis is called the novel pathogen, and then we have the endemic pathogen hypothesis. So, this one here. The novel pathogen is also called the out of Africa theory. And this person, Weldon and other people, went to Africa, to southern Africa, and found some old specimens in there. And they measured the genetic variation between the existing chytrid in different continents right now and find out that it's very low genetic variation. The animals you find in Central, the chytrid in Central America is exactly the same as the one you find in Australia. We know that it's from the 1960s when it starts spreading out. We know that it attacks everything. We haven't found anything resistant. And it's not really an immune response for animals. The animals don't seem to have the capacity to fight this fungus. They don't know this fungus. It just comes and attack. So this is what happened here. In 1938, they found the first specimen of Xenopus laetus in southern Africa. In 1943, Xenopus gili. And they live there happily. They're not dying. They just have the chytrid. But then in 1961, 23 years later, we found the first case out of Africa in Canada. And it was Arana clementans in Canada, 20 years later, like I said. And then the thing starts. And around the 70s, they start using Xenopus laevis a lot for pregnancy tests and different embryological studies. So they move a lot of Xenopus from South Africa to North America and Australia. So at the same time, you see in the 70s, we have the chytrid in I should use this, in North America and also in Australia. And after that, that's it. It starts spreading around South America, Central America, Europe, Africa, and finally 1999 gets to the islands in New Zealand and South America. Now, all the other spaces around, we don't know if it's just lack of research or it's not there. So nobody works in those areas, so we don't know where exactly it's at now. We assume everywhere.
Roberto, question.
Yes.
This is kind of a little bit off the track, but why Xenopus for pregnancy tests? What do you have any idea about the history of that? Why they?
It was in the beginning. It was very easy to reproduce. It was very easy to keep in captivity, and the hormones they produced were very easy to isolate. So what they do is when the woman is pregnant, the hormone that produces, they produce a reaction in some hormones in the Xenopus. So they found this pretty early, and they didn't know how to synthesize this in the lab, so they used real hormones for real Xenopus. And then in 1970s, around there, they start producing this synthetic hormone, and then the Xenopus were not used anymore, so they let them go. And in some places in Florida, when we still have populations of Xenopus in the wild right now. So the other theory is that the chytrid was always there. The chytrid, as part of this big family of fungi, was always present. And changes in the environment, like the global warming, temperature, pH, produces the animal to be more vulnerable to this fungus. So the fungus was always there and never killed anything. But when we start messing up with the environment, then the chytrid react and start killing people. Frogs. So the most popular ones are the suppression, immunosuppression for CNDK. Then Alan Pounds says that the things like in Monteverde, when you have less moist in the environment, the frogs will get together so they can use the little resources of water they have. And when they're all together, they will give the fungus to each other pretty easily. And of course, the radiation, the UV radiation, they used to think there was a big, they used to blame that in the 80s of everything. And now the most recent one is the peptides. They say that certain frogs have certain peptides together that stop the chytrid from growing and even kill the chytrid.
Within the skin?
Yeah, within the skin of the amphibians, yes. But we don't know how they got there, but we know there is everywhere. In this map, you see the black dots in here show the places where the chytrid is being found, and the black areas show where the chytrid can be. So, this is just America, and you can see it can be everywhere in America. I mean, not in Canada too much, but besides that, everywhere.
I guess it's too dry in some of those areas, the Great Plains areas.
Yeah, I have some gaps in here, in these areas here, like these deserts in here, and up in there. But besides those areas, everywhere seems like it's a great place for the chytrid to live. So who are the victims of this chytrid? Everything. Every amphibian. 90% of the amphibians seem to be declining. Right now, 50% decrease in the species. They say that by 2024, over 60% of the species of the world were going to be gone. Because of this thing, or decline at least. We've seen that it goes faster in stream environments, but they also get on terrestrial environments and it still kills in there. we find more chytrid in high elevation populations when it's colder. And the extinction seems to be hitting very hard the montane species, which, as you know, from southern Mexico, the highest diversity of amphibians is located in the mountains. So that's the problem right there. Who survives? Nobody really. But some species reduce their numbers to basal numbers, and they stay there for a while. We found things like Aglinis caledryas here, who presents basking behavior. So they bask. So they think they can elevate the temperature up to 30 degrees and maybe clean out the infection every day. We have things like prosopleponin here. We have a complex combination of peptides in the skin that seem to stop the chytrid from killing the frogs. Now, that is cool, you know, but the population is never the same. So it used to be 100 frogs with this, and now are 10 or 1 or 2. So 1 or 2 surviving, but it's not really recovering. So they are just survivors. So what is the problem? Why do they die? Why the chytrid is killing things? We have the most popular belief. What is happening is in this area here, in the ventral, the worst change occurs in this part of the body of the frog. So the chytrid creates extra layers of the skin in these areas here that stops the water from coming in and going out. So the solute levels in the blood start rising up pretty fast. So we have a lot of magnesium, a lot of potassium, a lot of calcium in the blood. And that's why you see how the blood gets all these varicose veins, like huge varicose veins, in big areas where the blood is just going crazy. So the sodium potassium pump gets blocked. There's no calcium getting in the cell. So the myosin in the muscles is not capturing any calcium, and the frog lose any movement of their limbs. So they are flaccid, they are dragging their legs. We don't know, we don't have evidence of any byproducts caused by the fungus. We don't know if they're actually producing anything that is any kind of substance, or venom or anything. So the chytrid is just blocking the water from coming out and going in.
Obviously, it creates some type of paralysis. Mm-hmm. But does it, and I guess that was the last point you're touching on. Have y'all documented anything with respect to high levels of certain types of byproduct? Byproducts.
Yeah, proved that the chytrid is actually producing anything. It's not like the chytrid is producing the paralysis. It's the lack of calcium in the muscle, the myosin, which is producing the paralysis of the frogs.
But what, as far as them dying, is it just because they become paralyzed, but then they actually do die? I mean, they have organ failure or something like that?
They have basically heart attacks at the end.
Okay.
Yes, the muscles start functioning, eventually the heart stops. Because you see, when they're dying, you see how they're struggling to breathe. They are actually, and you know, frogs don't have diaphragms, so they need to manually actually push the air down the throat. So they have to move the doorway all the time to push the air. So you don't have muscle movement, then you basically drown, or what you want to call it. So how's it look in the field? It's very dramatic, I tell you. It's very a thing to see. The animals look like healthy. This animal here is actually dead. And what you see is they leave their bodies trying to clear up the ventral patch, trying to have some exchange. And but they're lethargic, they start sloughing skin. You see the bunch of skin in their bodies. And then they just die. They just die standing like that. So sometimes you see things like this. This animal was gasping for air when we found it. And you see the extra layers of skin, how all the sloughing is occurring, all the skin is there. He's not capable to actually eat that skin, which normally a frog would eat the skin every day. But he can't. Sometimes they just die in a epileptic attack fashion. Sometimes they get eaten by birds or whatever when they cannot move. And sometimes they just stay there, dead, standing in there, in the night. So it's pretty dramatic. So next morning, the birds and raccoons and everything will come and eat him real quick. And sometimes they just fall in the water and they get carried downstream by the water. And this picture made the cover of Conservation Biology, yeah. So how does it move? How does it transmit from animal to animal? In local transmission, we think that what happened is the contact with frogs, where frogs are touching each other, either in amplexus, they're just touching each other, or they're fighting, or something, they're actually rubbing the skins each other, and that just moved the chytrid around. And for the environment, well, the animals live in the same places, and they stand in a leaf that is wet. When they leave, probably spores get in that little water, so when the next animal comes, stop in there, get the chytrid. And larvae, well, they live in the water, so the soil spores are swimming around. And how about country to country, or town to town, or region to region? We don't know, and of course people blame us, and people say the scientists that go to the sites are bringing the chytrid. So they say that people think that if you have a big piece of mud, piece of dirt inside, is kind of moist, and the chytrid can live inside that. So in your boots, in your truck, in your whatever, you can actually be carrying. Now, they like the keratin, so it can be also traveling in my nails, in my hair, in my every part of my skin. So we don't know. But we know that we bleach our boots, we bleach our trucks, but birds don't bleach their feathers, and insects don't bleach their bodies. And this is a picture of my site in Panama, and we have a road that goes through the site, and people move their cattle back and forth. And the cattle have these big chunks of mud attached to their tails and hooves and stuff. So how it moves, I don't know. Then other people think the soil spore is so tiny, they can actually hang on a drop of water and move with the wind and move with the moist. But see, this transmission is one of the big questions right now. How does it move? And particularly because it gets and affects everything at the same time. So when it gets there, it kills everything in a matter of months. But we know that it's moving, and we know that it's, these are just the sites that my professor has been working on since 87 till 2006. In 2007 is around here. We know that it's moving south right now, and it's moving around 20 kilometers a year. But we also know that it's moving north too, northbound in South America, so it's in southern Colombia already. So pretty much what we have left right now is eastern Panama and northern Colombia. And the rest, not good. So now I'm going to show you a little bit our research and what we do in this place called Copé. My professor worked in Copé for 7 years before I got there. I got there in 2003, and I lived in Copé for 2003 to 2005. And we survey everything every day, waiting for the chytrid to get there. And I got there in October 2004. So after the chytrid got there, we just basically will go every day and pick up bodies. And we pick up 347 animals, which is hard because we're competing with raccoons and birds and all these things. They actually eat things, so it's very hard. We found 40 species of 7 families, which is 70% of the fauna of the site. And attacking animals living in every place. We have canopy animals, we have animals that bore under the ground, we have aquatic animals, terrestrial animals, everything was here at the same time. And we found that everything had chytrid. So we sampled for a long time and there was nothing, and pop. And everything had chytrid and everything died very, very rapidly. This is a graph from this paper you guys are gonna read. It shows the captures. So the capture around this is when I moved to Copé. See the work intensify because I'm a very hard worker. And so these areas here, we're collecting every day. And then here in October 2004, things just drop dramatically. And when we see the mortality, we found nothing dead. If you think in the tropics, if one frog died, well, there are 3,000 raccoons waiting for that. But if 3,000 frogs died, then is when we start finding the frogs. So I say maybe during these years, one or two died from natural causes. But in 2004, the thing exploded, and everything died very, very. It's almost a straight line. So these are the how things were in December 2005. In December 2005, we found all these species that were 100% gone in a matter of months. And then we found these other species that were almost gone with like 99.1, 99.3, 99.5. By 2006, when we went there last time, not all the species was there. So they all were gone by then. Now you find one or two animals. It's more like a random occurrence more than anything else. So the frogs die. 80% of the frogs die, 50% of the species disappear. So that's pretty dramatic. So what happened with the tadpoles? What happened with the children? Care about the children here. And the children are gone too. They start dropping very, very fast. Once the tadpoles don't die out of the chytrid. The tadpoles can handle the chytrid fine. But if you don't have more tadpoles getting into the stream, then it's no more recruitment and things start dying. So this is my dissertation here. Our question is, when frogs died, when tadpoles died, then what happened? What is the real effect of the decline? What is the real the consequences of the decline in the environment? Because before this, everybody goes and counts how many species are gone. But nobody have gone there and actually see what is the effect in the ecosystems. How are the ecosystems being affected? So these are my tadpoles here. We have some fluctuation. This is the dry season. During the dry season, the tadpoles explode and then go down again during the wet season and supposed to pick up in here. But the second year, it's not pick up anymore. It's no more frogs laying eggs. So why is that a problem? We know the amphibians have a lot of roles in the ecosystem, and they have a lot of work that they need to do. We know they're very important moving energy. Eggs are coming in the stream, and somebody has to take the energy out. We know this very important part of the biomass. Born lichen, for example, worked with salamanders in New Hampshire and showed that the biggest input of biomass in New Hampshire in this forest was salamanders. So it's very important. We know they're moving the nitrogen, the nutrient cycling in the stream. And they work in decomposition of leaf litter, moving phosphorus. And of course, they are facilitating food for other invertebrates, like insects. So they peel off the first layer of algae so the insects can eat the second layer, or they produce particular organic matter that can be eaten by insects. So they're very, very important. But all these studies we have in here has been done in temperate zones or with adults. Nobody knows what exactly the tadpoles do. So I put here a little bit. This is a typical ecosystem, probably the same here in Tennessee. So you have leaves getting stream, you have insects eating the leaves, some animals eating the insects, the thing goes around, the energy goes around. Now in the tropics, this is a little variation in this system because in the tropics we have tadpoles. And tadpoles do the exact same functions that insects do in here. So we have shredders, we have filters, we have grazers, we have all kinds of tadpoles doing all kinds of different jobs down there. So if we see ecosystem in the tropics, we'll have the same components of the ecosystem in Tennessee, but we add tadpoles to every one of the ecosystem levels. So this is a little flowchart here to show you how this thing works. Well, you know, energy goes in the form of energy or leaf litter, egg masses. It primary producers take the light and produce algae, which is eaten by the primary consumers. Tadpoles here are scraping, are breaking down those leaves and producing food for the secondary consumers. At the same time, tadpoles are going out, bringing energy back to the forest, and producing zestum and producing food for the other insects and fish, and also going out as neonates and feeding snakes and feeding things like that. So basically, the same exact same thing. So this is just to put all that in words. We know that, for example, in my site, larvae is very abundant in the dry season, and adults are abundant in the wet season. So the idea was to get all the points that can be affected by the decline. when you have, when you disrupt that food web, what happened with all the different components on that food web? The algae, primary consumers, the tadpoles. How about the things, the eating tadpoles, like snakes and things that are waiting for the tadpoles to come out? The insects, they need the tadpoles to break down those leaves and produce that particular organic matter, and overall the food webs. So this group of people here is a project called the Tropical Amphibian Disease in the Streams, and it's a National Science Foundation project that we are down there all working in different corners of this stream trying to get the big, big picture. So this is where things happen. This is my study site in Panama. Let me get a sip of this. This is my study site in Panama. If anybody been in Panama before, this is the city of Panama, and here in the middle is our little humble town of El Copé, and we have our national park in there, and we work in there. Wonderful place to work. We have all kinds of animals in there. We have 76 species of amphibians, 68 frogs, mostly breeding in the dry, in the wet season. In the streams, we have 22 species of tadpoles. 9 of those are very, very common, and we found tons of these things. In 2001, we record 50 animals per square meter in the densities. Really, really nice in the stream, beautiful streams. And then, of course, the tadpole community was awesome. We have filters and grazers and collective gatherers. We have tadpoles doing all the jobs and frogs doing all the jobs. It was a great place. So what we wanted to do was, first, before the decline happened, was to go down there and see how much energy the tadpoles were actually contributing to this ecosystem. So when the decline happened, we can see how much energy we're actually losing. So to measure the energy flow, there's 4 steps we need to follow. First, we need to know what is in there, how many animals, the densities, where they live, where they're eating. Then how fast are they growing? So if you have this many animals eating this, growing this fast, producing this much amount of biomass, and then we get all this together, put in a fancy equation, and we get the exact production in energy-wise, how much energy the tadpoles are contributing. So for the density, we went down there, and we select 4 transects and select different techniques to be able to cover all the species of tadpoles. So with these different techniques, we were able to find all the species of tadpoles and account the densities of each of these tadpoles. We did this 576 times. And this is what we found. We found the, like I showed you before, there is a low here during the wet season where there's not many tadpoles. And then the adults are laying the eggs, of course. Then the eggs are in the water and the tadpoles explode and we have a high diversity, a high density, and then go down again when they, once they get out of the water. This is all the species combined. It's habitat weighted too. So it shows all the sites, all the potential habitats, and all the tadpoles. And we did the abundance, and we find out the all year round you find tadpoles. And there are a couple of species that are very dominant. This is the called rocket frogs, and these are both hyla, the tree frogs. So basically, those animals take over, not because they're bigger, but because they're a lot of animals. So it was a beautiful place, like I said. Then we went back and tried to find out how fast they grow. How do you know how an animal grows, how fast it grows? So we put these little chambers in here, and inside those chambers we place a tadpole. And we measured the tadpole before, putting it in there for 40 days, and went back and measured it again to see how much it grew in 40 days. So these are as natural as possible. This stream is here, so we assume that the nutrients and everything is standard. And then when we have these numbers, we create this fancy equation here, and we get a growth rate, which is this. So we plug these things, and we have the different speed of growth for tadpoles here. And we found the important part in here is we have some tadpoles that grow very fast, which means they're turning energy very fast, and which is the animals that were more abundant. You remember the rocket frogs. And then things like hylas, they move the energy very slow because they take a year to grow, and so it's very slow, a slow process. So to get the biomass, we took these animals to stay in the chambers, and we dried the animals, we wet the animals, we burned them and reweighted, and we obtained the ash-free dry mass. Once you have the ash-free dry mass, then you create these regressions in which you can extrapolate these animals and then go back to collect for the last 10 years and extrapolate all those animals, and you know how much biomass we here every decade, whatever. And once you have that, So, and this is what we found. We found the Colostitus, which you remember was the most abundant animal, is actually contributing not that much biomass because they're small. And Hyla, which is moving energy very slow, but they're pretty big animals, they're actually giving the big chunks of biomass to the environment. And things like this, like ranas, they are very centralized only in certain times of the year, but they give big chunks of biomass because there are a lot of those. So now we have biomass and we have the growth rate. So we put all this in this equation and we create this line. And the area underneath the line is the production. So the production we measure in milligrams per ash-free dry mass per square meter per year. And these curves are all being produced for insects. So it's the first time that actually vertebrates like amphibians are being tested with these curves. But they work great. So, and these were our results. We divided here by seasons. So we have the, again, the rocket frogs. We were not contributing the most biomass, but now come back and give the most production. Why? Because they're moving the energy very fast. So we have a lot of animals moving a lot of energy very fast. And even though they're small, they're producing a lot of energy. Then followed by the hylas. And of course, in the wet season, all these animals are very reduced. So the hylas are the one picking up the slack in there. And we find out that our annual production was 96.86 milligrams. And that, if you have read about production, is very low. This is a very low compared with the environments in here. But for tropical systems, it's actually pretty good. So the tadpoles are actually contributing an important part of the energy in these streams. But, like we said before, the things decline. So once the tadpoles decline, we start losing things. In less than 3 months, we lost 47% of our biomass, 72% of our production lost in a matter of 3 months. So, like I said, 95% of the density dropped, 47% of the biomass, and 72% of production was lost in 3 months. And this is still taking into account some months there were some tadpoles. If I go and do this today, it will be 100% in all those three things. So if we go back to our fancy figure here, we found that this area here is being affected now. We have the energy coming in the same, but we don't have the same amount of primary consumers now working. So it's less metamorphosis, it's less energy going to the secondary consumers, and consequently is less energy going outside for the snakes to eat and everything. And this is affecting, of course, everybody. It's affecting these macroinverts in here, these macroinverts in here, the fish, the snakes. Everything is being affected because of this decline. So what is going to happen in these streams? What is going to be the real consequence of these declines? There are certain things we think that could happen. First, could happen that the insects or other macroinverts will take over, and they will start reproducing in big numbers, and they will just pick up the slack of the energy that we're losing. The other one is the things are going to start, like algae is going to bloom, and we're going to have a lot of primary production, but nothing to turn that primary production into secondary production. Or it's just only a bunch of energy there that is going to be waste, and nothing is going to use this energy, and we're going to have all these systems with all this energy not transformed. So far what it looks like is that this is a paper that is being written right now by Connolly from the University of Georgia, and these are our tadpole numbers. These are densities of tadpoles, and he had the algae and how the algae is changing in these streams. So you see the algae is when these are low tadpoles, it's low algae all the time. And then in October around there, tadpoles start going down and algae start going up. So we have these excessive blooms of algae going on. These are mostly diatoms, which he's mentioning here. It's the biofilm on top of the other things. That's happening in water. So what happened outside the water? What's happening with snakes, with lizards, spiders, or birds? They normally eat these things. We find out it's a person, Chad Montgomery, working with the snakes. So he went back and looked at the snakes and see how the food contents of these animals change from April to October. And as you see, the yellow part here shows the amount of amphibians consumed by these snakes, or show actually the snakes that eat amphibians and how much were they eating. And you see every time it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And by October, these snakes are starving. So he went and found this couple of animals of the same species. This animal lives nearby a pond with these steel frogs. And this animal lives right next to the stream. As you can see, the fat bodies in this one, they're huge. They have a lot of fat, and it's a pretty fat, healthy snake. And this one here have nothing. It's starving to death. And probably what is going to happen, this is going to starve. And these include snakes and lizards and other things. So what is going to be... what's going to happen after this? What is once the chytrid pass kills everything, kills the snakes, the lizards, the frogs, what is going to be left for us to work on? We have some survivors. We find some things persist, like we said before. Maybe they have basking behaviors. Maybe they have a special combination of peptides in their skin, and they survive. But they are very, very low numbers. And we've seen how every place that is moist and high altitude, things are dying. And in the dry season, in a dry forest, in warm sides, we have some animals left. But the reality is that in Latin America, where these things is based, there's not much lowland forest left. So, not much frogs. And it's attacking particularly the higher the mountains, where the most, the higher number of endemic species live. In very low ranges, very, very small ranges, so they die pretty fast. So I ask you, what is the solution? What can we do about this? We know there is no way to stop it. We know we cannot just create a river of bleach and put it in the stream. We know that all the species get affected. We know that it's moving every day to new sites. I was talking to Matt today that I need to go back to Panama because I need to do some more sampling, but I don't have any more streams. I have to go every day. I have to go farther south trying to find streams, and every time I get there, they're gone. So we're running out of places, and it's natural places, national parks, where there's no disturbance whatsoever. We know that we can treat in captivity. We take the frogs and we submerge them in copper baths, and they will get better. But who has the big copper bath to put everything? So the time is running out, and so far it seems to, the captive breeding will be one of the most interesting solutions. But it's a little problem with this. And the problems with the captive breeding is politics. It's a little politics involved. Countries are very protective of their frogs, of the animals. And even if they would say, okay, go ahead and do it, where do we start? Who choose which frogs to save? I'll save this one because it's pretty nice. But how about a cricket frog? Pretty ugly. So who's going to save that? Who's going to decide how this is going to happen, and where do you want to put these animals? We have so many species in very little space. And things like, we don't have any information either. We have things like this thing, Tractus fasciatus. We don't even know what it eats. So we cannot feed them. We have some of those in captivity, and we didn't know what to feed them. They wouldn't eat anything. They live in a canopy. They never come down. And the biggest problem is, where are you going to put these things? If somebody go ahead and say, I'll give you $3 billion right now, that's very nice. But we have 5,800 species of frogs in the world. How many tanks is that we need? Right now, in the United States, there are only 37 species in captivity, around 200 animals. And this is the best place, when they have the most. Like I said before, who's going to choose this? We're going to choose the pretty ones, the charismatic megafauna, and the nice-looking frogs because they're red and blue and green. And thing like this, they never come outside. They live on the ground and never do anything. So we're going to choose this one. And how much money that will cost to save all these animals?
Would the intent, I guess, with the captive breeding program be then to try to reintroduce them at some time once we figure out the science?
Well, no, because the creature just stays there. It's a big problem. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it's a species called the Kihansi spray toad from Tanzania and Africa. And the Kihansi spray toad is extinct from the wild. We don't have any more in the wild. And they have like anything between 17 and 50 animals at the zoo, in the Bronx Zoo. And they're not breeding, they're not doing anything, they're old relatives, so it's a gigantic bottleneck they're going through. But even if they get better, and they start reproducing, and we start having tons of animals, we cannot bring them back to the gorge because they will die. I cannot get species back in my site because they will die in a matter of days. And there's no way you can keep 5,800 species in the zoo. It'll be cool, but we're going to do this. So the approaches right now is we have this project going on called the Noah's Ark Project, in which we go to a site and create these facilities and go and pull a bunch of animals from the wild and put them in captivity till we figure out what to do. But we get the exact same problems. We cannot have a Noah's Ark project in every site from here till southern Colombia. It's not money enough to do that. And so how can we, in situ, in the place, it's no idea. We don't know how to stop this fungus. We don't know how can we stop this thing from killing. So we haven't found any way to link both things. Like Matt said, we go, we save the animals, and they put them back in the environment. We don't know how to do that. So far what we're trying to do is get the animals, get some information, at least know what they eat, at least know what they breed, and things like that. So for the few lucky species that are in captivity, they can actually survive. But what is the future? Are the amphibians doomed to be extinct in the next 100 years, 200 years? Is there a way to stop the chytrid? And how? What's going to happen with the ecosystems? If we're losing 98 grams of energy per year, it may not sound too much, but if you add everything, every little, this is a 100-meter reach that we work in. You add this in every 100 meters for the whole stream, and we're probably losing pounds of energy. And so what's going to happen with the snakes, with the lizards, with the frogs, with the birds, with the herpetologists? What are we going to do? So that's pretty much it. This is what I had planned for you guys. Some acknowledgement to people, and the people give the money and stuff like that. And I don't know if you guys have any comments or questions.
Yes.
No. It's some people think that maybe they have in lizards, but the problem is the osmo regulation in lizards is a bit different. They actually have kidneys, and they actually have, you know, exchange that is not through the skin. So the only thing that actually is moving waste through the skin is fish and amphibians. And fish are in the water, so they don't have any problem. But amphibians are outside, so those are the ones that so far is screwed.
It's kind of along with Nathan's questions. Can you perceive any negative consequences of a snake, for example, eating chytrid infected?
Well, I don't know if it's known the capacity of the chytrid to survive the intestinal tract of a snake, but snakes have scales, so potentially it can be in the chitin of the scales, so it can be hanging in there. So that's it. I can have it in my nails right now. I've been working there for a long time, so I may have it in my nails. So tomorrow I'm going to the Smokies with you guys. I'm going to swap that population.
any thoughts on our capabilities? Do you think it's even realistic? It's more architect, but obviously we're just trying to figure out Kittredge right now. But what about ultimately? And completely off the wall, or playing.
I don't think it's that. Well, I don't know how hard. I don't work with that, but I wouldn't think it's that difficult to create a resistant kind of frog. The problem is that in 100 years from now, we'll have one species.
Right.
So it'll be being herpetology will be pretty easy.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know the species that you work on. So I guess create something that can go back to the field is not the big of a deal. Is create is try to stop this thing from killing that is the problem. Because like right now, like in my site, it is nothing there. I mean, it's nothing. I used to go to this site every night and find 150 frogs a night of 25 species in one poor night, not even good, regular night. And now it is nothing, absolutely nothing.
Along 100 meters?
Yeah.
Upstream?
Mm-hmm.
How many?
Like 27, 25, depend the day.
Wow.
And you hear a bunch more that you don't even see.
Yeah.
And like they say, you see one, you miss three. So how many are in there? You know, but now you go now and it's nothing, literally nothing. And you go to every place between Mexico to Panama and go above 500 meters and you don't find any frogs. There's nothing there.
What's your hypothesis? So, if, you know, we've talked a little bit about it, and we get on it too, is that it seems that lower elevations, Kittredge is, it infects it, but it doesn't seem to be negatively impacting the population. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it seemed like between 24 and 31 degrees, the thing is there, but it doesn't. I don't know really if it doesn't kill or we kill. These are lowland animals in the tropics are more. You know, the river is small in the beginning and then gets bigger. And when it gets down to the lowlands, it's a big system, big river like the ones you have here. So the animals in here, we change from very narrow distribution, almost endemic species, to a very broad, very abundant. Are breeding animals. So we have tons of animals. So we have, like here you have, if you kill 100 bullfrogs in a pond, what's going to happen? But if you kill 100 hemifractus, I don't think you can even find 100 hemifractus to kill. So maybe in the lowlands, things are dying as much as in the highlands. It's just the populations are more capable to take it than they are in the highlands. Or maybe they're not dying. We don't know that yet.
Yeah.
We have somebody in my lab that is trying to figure that out. At least why the some species persist and others don't. I can tell you in tadpoles, there's some species that lose all the mouth parts in a matter of weeks. And the other species don't. Other species keep their mouth parts. And Ron Altig said that it's probably because the rate of replacing the mouth part is what actually is affecting. If you don't replace it that often, then you keep the mouth you have. If you start replacing is when you lose the original one and get the new one's coming. There's no new one to come, so the gaps are starting there. But so you have animals in my streams that are tadpoles, they're eating and they're doing fine. But they go outside and die all of them at the same time. So who knows if those populations are stable or just remains what it used to be. And all the thing is, we don't know how many animals used to be before. So we see 100 and it seems a lot, but maybe it's not.
Yeah, how many did y'all described a number of brand new species? I mean, how many
down
just in your study site?
Oh, well, my study site is a lot. It's a, working down there is pretty different. It's very cool because this place is nobody ever been, and no herpetologist at least been. So we have the luxury to describe animals just based in plain morphology. And it's a story, a friend of mine, and we have this mountain here, and right across the valley was another mountain. And we never go there because you have to walk, and you know, we're pretty lazy, so we never did. And we're pretty busy in our streams. So one day we have a weekend off or something, and we decided to go to to check it out to see if the kitten was there, because it was hitting our sight. So we climbed the mountain, stayed for one night, and came back and described three new species. And they weren't even a small, confusing, maybe not species. They were. I have one that was this big and completely red and all these different things you never see in your life. So it's not even, we didn't even look for. And in my side, they're like a little bit of the ones that maybe not. We have like four or five species only during my time. And then describe a bunch more. And this is one place that's relatively accessible too. So you go to the mountains right next door.
So there's a good chance that there are
the country, Nicaragua, the cold country. Never herpetology have walked through these mountains. So what is in there? Oh, yeah. Yeah, my professor described a species that when the paper came out, the species was already gone. We knew because she was describing it as the kitchen was happening. So when she finished the paper, the animal was gone. You may say that. They are very, these places have very narrow distribution species with very, very specific ecological requirements. So you have animals that live in this corner and that's it. And you kill these 10 animals, that's probably it for these animals. And they, in the tropics, what happened is the glaciation, when they got down there, it wasn't as strong as here, so it was a little bit milder, but so the mountain peaks stay rainforest. So all these species diverge during this time, the radiation happened, and when the things get joined together, each mountain was like an island. So you can have a completely different species composition from this mountain to that mountain. And it's ridiculous. You go and you cross, and it's a different world. We have animals that literally, if it's in the east, it is like this side of the continental divide is one thing, and this part of the continental divide is another thing. So you can collect in here and collect in here, and it's literally a different species. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I guess their dispersal capability is non-existent for many of
these. I don't think they move. They have so much food and so much everything in this little match. Why would they even move? Why to migrate to any places? Yeah, because the snakes do the same, insects and everything. So everything eats everything too. Yeah.
Additional questions, guys?
Collecting tadpoles of the what? To see if they die out of the kitchen? Oh, yeah, tons. Because we have our own keys, because for these places there are no keys. So we build our own keys, so most of them have to be raised because it's impossible to see the difference by hand, yeah.
Can you explain a little bit more about the Noah's Ark project?
The Noah's Ark project is global amphibian assessment
program
that give some money to certain zoos. The Detroit Zoo have called the Amphibian Conservation Center, something like that it's called, and the Atlanta Zoo, Joe Mendelson working there. It's like four or five zoos, they are together. And the idea started when the Kihansi toad started crashing and they start looking for facilities to put this animal. And after that happened, they decided, well, we should do this in other places. So they went down to Panama. After our site crash, they went to the next logical site when it was going to hit. And they went down there and they basically started surveying to see what we have. And at that point, they start building a facility that they can keep all the animals. And as they were building the thing, the chytrid hit the site, and things started dying. So they were rapidly collect everything they could and start putting in this facility. And basically, they didn't have the facilities, so they still don't have the facilities, like the right facilities. So they give copper baths to these animals every day, pretty much. So every day they treat them, or every other day they treat them with copper and keep them healthy that way, because they're still in that area. And you don't know if it's moving with the air or what. And they are building this facility that is going to be able to hold these animals in a very sterile environment, so the animals will be able to reproduce. They have, I think it's right now like 2 species, and they have a couple of specimens of each, and they haven't bred anything successfully because they live in tanks this big right now. But the idea is to have facilities big enough that they can actually breed and actually see if they can keep the population stable. The problem is a lot of these animals are so specific, like I said, that we have a lot of animals that live in tree holes and they never leave the tree hole. So create the, you can put a piece of tree in there, I guess a bamboo or something, but I bet it's not the same. It's like, this is too short. It doesn't look too high from here. So they haven't been able to breed these animals successfully, but they are holding a lot of species that they in this site, because the chytrid already passed through this site. So in this area, you don't find any more frogs in a while. So in this area, all the frogs are in this center right now. And they're just waiting. Right now, it's a lot of problems with the Panamanian government, because they what happened with the Quijano toad was the Tanzanian government declared the animal as property of the country, as I guess you may say, like the pandas in China. So to do anything with these frogs, you have to have permission of the, I don't know, the senator, I don't know exactly who is the one that says that, but it's a big deal for everything to move an animal or to preserve an animal because it died. You have to go through a stack of bureaucracy to be able to do that. So it's very, very hard. And right now they don't like us in Panama one bit. So we don't get permits or anything right now.
And you're saying that the Panamanian government, although you all are working to learn about the chytrid fungus and to understand it and obviously work towards conservation ultimately, which is still trying to understand the biology of this thing that's moving so fast.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll figure stuff out when it's already too late probably, or we will never figure it out. Recently, y'all have, the Panamanian government got very protective about quote-unquote foreigners, and especially United States scientists. And actually collecting animals.
Well, it's I guess that gets very political, and it's very difficult concept to understand for a person that doesn't have any biological training. And you tell my grandma this, my grandma say, well, you don't touch these things. They were fine before you got here. Why would they die? And that's exactly the approach. And it's like, we don't want scientists going there with the dirty boots and the dirty trucks. But tapirs move around, you know, with the dirty hooves. So they don't want us there because they think we are the ones doing that. And they have a big, big conflict. And is these guys are not just killing our frogs. They are, whatever is left, taking with them to the United States. So the Americans can see the frogs, but they can't. And they don't understand the first at all. They don't even exhibit in the zoos, and there's no facilities to put these animals. And, well, we're not killing anything. So it gets very political and very difficult. And the biggest problem is the places with the highest biodiversity in the world, amphibians, are the poorest countries. So when you get down to Ecuador, it's worse. In Bolivia, it's worse. And in those places, it's just terrible. Colombia, we can't even work in Colombia because it'll kill you. Or kidnap you, it's, you know, the same, I guess. So it's very political and it's very difficult. And right now the Global Assessment Amphibian Program is, they're trying to get money, the secure money, so they can have more of these things running, create more of these centers. And they are looking for somebody who wants to, a private person, I guess they're looking for, they wanna donate $1 billion. So you guys, you have $1 billion? Happy. They're looking for like all those guys to be able to say like Microsoft saved the frogs. And So they're trying to get something like that to happen. But so far, nobody can come out with $1 million, $1 billion.
They run similar types of projects for systems like the tropical rainforest.
Except, well, that's the biggest problem we were talking the other day, and is that we push for the frogs, or the frogs push for the monkeys, and the other one push for the insects, and the other one push for the fish. So we have $1 billion each. So which animal, and hey, pandas are much nicer looking than that frog. So the pandas are the ones that get all the money. So that's the biggest problem. Yeah.
Are there any scientists in Panama that y'all work with that can help create, be a liaison between scientists from around the world, really, and the Panamanian government, or is it?
Well, it is. We have people in our site that's still there. We have right now a grad student that she's working in more in the effects of the snakes in the frogs, in the exact same place where we've always been. And then we have very good contacts with the Smithsonian Institution. Have a big campus in Panama. But the problem is the zoo people in the last year have produced all this conflict, and the government is pretty right now upset with us. And as it is right now, every scientific permit related to frogs in the country is frozen. Nobody have permit to work with frogs in this moment in the country. So we're trying to look for loopholes and trying to find little corners. This summer we have some money from National Geographic, and we're gonna go to East Panama and you go to new sites that nobody ever been, and trying to establish new sites and trying to find new populations. And so we're trying to get the permits to do that, because we need to collect a lot of animals, and we're trying to do that outside the Smithsonian, because I guess the government relates the Smithsonian with the whole problem with the zoos, so they don't want to give us permits through the Smithsonian. So we're going and using other people to try to get some permits, and hopefully, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if they're going to realize that we are not in the same boat and we're not trying to kill anything. And we have explained many, many times that that's not true, that we're not bringing anything, that we're not killing anything, that we're trying to save them and stuff. And hopefully someday they will realize that we're not as bad as we look.
How many other teams are down there studying Kittredge? Is it pretty much y'all's lab?
In Panama? Yeah. In Panama, it's pretty much us. It's a group of people that are working in. We have some people, there's some people working in Bolivia, I think, right now. But it's very difficult, access there, so they're not doing too well. Australia is doing a lot of work. And then it's a lot of people from Germany working in Africa, actually, in Central Africa, and what is Congo and Republic of Congo and those areas. But in Panama, it's basically the person, Smith Rollins, they're doing the peptides. They work in our side, too. And the person, Ross Alford, who's doing the solutes in the blood of the animals, is also working on our side. So it's we have three sites in Panama, and that's it, pretty much what it is right now. The idea is to open new sites now this year for more people to go and work in there. And it's a pretty big open field. We're still looking for that brilliant idea that's going to stop the Kittredge. So if any of you have the idea, bring it. Comments?
Tomorrow, Roberto and I, we're going to go to the Sunspot on Cumberland Avenue at 5 o'clock. And also, that's the time when Ecology and Evolutionary Biology has their social. So we'll be there and invite you all and pass the word around. And that'll give you an opportunity to interact socially with Roberto and ask some more questions if you want. But also, of course, he'll be with us on Saturday. Hopefully, it won't be too long over.
with my Kittredge boots.
We'll have time to interact with Roberto up in the Appalachians, which I guess we've known each other now for 8 years or so. And one of the first things when he came from Costa Rica, an area with, how many species does your country have? amphibians?
Oh, amphibians? Plenty. Like 140 species,
yeah.
150 species of
frogs. Yeah, I mean, massive species-rich country. And we were talking, he goes, you know, I want to go to the Appalachians and see the salamanders. I want to see the salamander diversity.
Yeah.
And so finally,
it's very different.
Later,
In the tropics, our salamanders are pretty boring. We don't have anything colorful in the tropics of salamanders. They were brown or black, or we have some tree salamanders are pretty cool with prehensile tails and why not, but we don't have anything that is colorful. And so when I came here for the first time, if I saw my first tiger salamander, it was very impressive because it was gigantic and so colorful. And and the smokies, I always wanted to go because they hold the blue ones and green ones and yellow ones. And I live in Illinois, and we don't have that many. We have a couple of orange ones, but that's it. And then the frogs, they're crazy down there, but here they're pretty boring. So that's what I work down there most of the time. Tadpoles are pretty everywhere. That's where they go. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Roberto.